University, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Glenn Kinder. Just before I do that, I have several announcements that I've been asked to deliver, and I'll try to remember all of them here. First, Dr. Kinder is with us through today, tomorrow, and he returns on Friday, I think it was, and he will be giving another public lecture on campus that Thursday, October the 7th. Can we be good without God in search of moral foundations? And this is in IRC 4, and it's 12:30 noon, just a couple of doors down. That's one announcement. We have some books available here, as you can see, for those of you may be interested in Dr. Kinder's book. I'm going to give it a plug so he doesn't have to do it. I'm not going to promote my own book, though. That's available, plus the very fine essay he published first in the Atlantic Monthly, Can We Be Good Without God, on the political meaning of Christianity. A fine essay. I read that long before I knew that Dr. Kinder would be coming here, and circulated that amongst my friends. One of the finest essays I've read for a long time. And very helpful, too. So that also is available on the table as well. I want to then introduce Dr. Kinder. This lecture series is sponsored by the generosity of the Murin Foundation, the Murin Fund, and members of the UBC Graduate Faculty Christian Forum have done, I think, most of the organizing behind all of this, so we have them to thank as well. Dr. Kinder, Glenn Kinder, is the author of a very distinguished list of publications, which I'm not going to even attempt to summarize, but I've held up a couple of the most recent and premier of his publications, one of which I will purchase when this lecture is over, I think. And that's this book here. But Can We Be Good Without God, the Atlantic Monthly article, The Political Meaning of Christianity, published by Harper in 1989, and then Against Fate, an essay on personal dignity, Notre Dame University Press in 1981. It is my pleasure then to introduce him. He is coming to us as professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Not quite emeritus yet, he tells me, still actively teaching, and a fine teacher, if what I heard yesterday is any indication of what we're going to hear again today. So welcome once again to our cohort.
Thank you very much. Again, as I did yesterday, I want to give a dialogical speech, if there is such a thing. I want to talk rather than something that is prepared, and I'd like to talk in a way which is intended at least to be a personal interchange and not just an announcement of opinions, which I expect you to accept. What time should I forget the schedule yesterday. What time should I... All right. That's what I'll aim at, and I look forward particularly to the discussion. So if I say something that offends you, I hope you'll be prepared to let me know what it was. Let me briefly recall what I spoke of yesterday. There may be some of you here who weren't here yesterday. And what I said yesterday was designed to discover the nature of hope, lay a foundation for talking about the politics of hope. The politics of hope is my subject for today. But let me just remind you of what I said yesterday. I began with the notion that what we hope for is not any particular finite good, but rather for something beyond, for an infinite and eternal and limitless good, which you could call transcendent. That's just one of many possible words which can be used. Or, to call it what Christians call it, God. Now, that hope is ultimately for God, for something limitless and enduring, and not for any of the finite goods which pass away. And finite hopes have their place, but only so far as they fit in the hopes for the infinite and the eternal. I then tried to suggest what it means to live with hope. And I suggested that it means some things which we're not usually prepared for. It means certain things which, in general, human beings, I don't think in our time at least, connect with hope. It means not looking into the future, which we're unable to do. Since what we hope for is an encounter with transcendence, since we can't know what that means, hope does not mean dwelling within the future, trying to predict, trying to understand the future. Hope means entrusting yourself to the future, but not trying to look ahead. It means what Isaiah called walking in darkness, and not trying to imagine or to comprehend or to control what is going to happen in the future. Since we can't live into the future in the sense of comprehending it, what hope does mean is living resolutely in your present situation, trying to understand who you are. And it means trying to live in accordance with the demands that are placed on you in your existing situation. And it means, in addition, and this is perhaps the greatest anomaly in true hope, as I understand it, and that is that it means looking back, because your present situation has grown out of the past, and because we have been given powers of memory, even though we haven't been given powers of foresight, except to a very feeble degree. These powers of memory we must exercise in order to discover the foundations of our present situation, in order to discover the meaning which transcendence brings into the temporal process. That's too swift for you, perhaps, to be comprehensible to you altogether, if you weren't here yesterday, but it may refresh your minds if you were here on what I tried to say, and it may lay some kind of a foundation for the sort of things that I want to say today. Today I want to talk, as I indicated, about the politics of hope. Now it might seem, when I turn to the politics of hope, as though I'm doing this mainly just because I'm a political scientist. If you happen to know that I am, it might seem, in other words, that politics doesn't have very much connection with hope, and that it's all right, you could talk about politics in connection with hope, but you could talk about dozens of other things in connection with hope. And I want to start by trying to convince you, with a few brief remarks, that this is not so. To hope genuinely, you have to hope politically. You have to hope with a political attitude, in a political frame of mind. The reason for this lies in something that I talked about yesterday. The reason for this lies in the fact that the transcendence, the God for which we hope, dignifies individual human beings. The transcendence, or the God which we hope we are living toward, bestows sanctity or infinite worth on each human being. On each human being. This means that you can't be indifferent to any member of the human species. This means that you have to be concerned with every human being. Every human being has to be a matter of interest and a responsibility if you are living towards God, if you are living towards transcendence. This dictates political thinking and political responsibility, because politics means basically thinking about the state of human beings at large, trying to understand what needs to be done for human beings in general, and trying to understand what you in particular must do and can do for human beings in general.
If you leave out this political dimension, then you're not concerned with transcendence. You're not concerned with God, because God is concerned with everyone. Transcendence relates to everyone. And if you leave out transcendence and think only about yourself in relation to God, then you're not related to transcendence. That's related to God. Because God is concerned with everyone. Now you can see that this is a somewhat unusual conception of politics. Politics doesn't necessarily involve electioneering or supporting a particular candidate or lobbying or running for office or activities of the kind which we in the United States and you in Canada connect with politics. It doesn't necessarily involve activities of that sort. What it involves basically is taking thought and taking responsibility for your fellow human beings everywhere and trying to act in accordance with what is needed by your fellow human beings everywhere. Now this may lead you to electioneering. In fact, I think it will lead you in some way to a concern with government and with candidates who are running for governmental office. It may lead you into a great deal of political activity of the ordinary sort, but it may not. It might possibly be expressed in other terms. But you are thinking politically whenever you're thinking about the state of your fellow human beings and of trying to assume responsibility for your fellow human beings. This may seem too broad to you, but I think that this can be defended against criticisms which might be brought against it. And some of you in the question period might want to do that. But let us start there, at any rate. I'll leave this in the status of a suggestion, but I think it's an important place to start with, that to engage in hope, you've got to be of a political mind. You've got to have a political cast of mind, because that is required by hope for the human race, for your fellow human beings. That's a beginning point. Now let me come to a second, rather fundamental proposition having to do with the political meaning of hope. This is controversial. Some Christians would very much disagree with me about this matter. But the proposition I put to you is this, that hope can't be conservative if conservatism means opposition to change. We often call conservative things which really don't mean opposition to change. Defense of free markets, for example, is not opposition to change, because free markets bring dynamic change. We often call that conservatism, but that's not what I'm talking about. Conservatism, in the truest sense of the word, is the kind of doctrine enunciated by Edmund Burke. And even with Burke, it wasn't a doctrine of complete opposition to change. But the conservative, to the extent that the conservative sticks to conservative principles, is a desire to preserve what is old and established. It's a desire to preserve existing customs and traditions. And the conservative may allow for the modification of these for the sake of preserving them, but the emphasis is on preservation, on conservation. And the proposition I'm putting to you is that this is incompatible with hope in the fullest sense of the word. If you have hope, you have to be willing to change. Because hope is living into the future. And hope, political hope, means that the society you're a member of is changing and evolving into something different from what it is now. In other words, the politics of hope is a reformist politics of some sort. And I can imagine that some of you will strongly disagree with this assertion, and I hope you'll disagree with me publicly as soon as I've finished talking. But this seems to me to be the truth about hope, that if you have hope and live it politically, as you have to, if it is true hope, then you are more or less open to change. Now, it's important
for one who is open to change, it's important for one who is concerned with reform to realize that there are limits of some kind. There are limits on us. There are limits as to how far we can go. And we know this from the Gospels, from the Synoptic Gospels. Jesus, of course, all of you know this, presents a picture of a disastrous conclusion to the historical process. He presents a picture of a time of wars and rumors of wars, a time of famine and earthquake, and a time of terrors. There's no mistaking when you read Jesus' words, either in Mark 14 or in Luke and Matthew 24, if I remember correctly, there's no mistaking when you read Jesus' words that the historical process is going to end in catastrophes. One can't know exactly what kind of catastrophe or when. But one thing this very clearly says to us is that there are limits on reform. These eschatological passages in the New Testament should make us humble reformers. They should make us realize that we are finite, erring human beings and that the possibilities before us are limited. Nevertheless, I suggest to you that we don't know just how much we can do along lines of reform. We don't know what God's intention prior to the final end of history is. We don't know the nature of God's intention. And consequently, we have no right to look at needs in the world, like the needs of the hungry or those who are being killed in wars. We have no right to look at those needs and say, well, we are erring, finite human beings, and history is going to end in catastrophe, and there's not really much we can do about it. It would seem to me that as long as the end is not manifestly upon us, we are obliged to probe and to try different directions of change and reform. I would suggest even that we shouldn't rule out definitely the possibility of socialism. I don't like socialism, and it seems to me that socialism in our time has been either disastrous or boring, depending on what country that you were talking about. So I don't recommend socialism with any kind of inner fervor at all. But I have to tell myself that I can't rule out the possibility that socialism of some sort is a possibility before the human race. It would be doctrinaire. It would be contrary to the fact that we don't know God's intentions for us to say that there can never be any kind of socialism, that this is ruled out for all time. So I think that a politics of hope is a politics of change, a politics of trial and error and of experiment and of trying various different things towards improving the social order and the state of human beings in general. Now, having said this much, I come back to this scheme of future, present, and past, the scheme of what it means to live with hope in history. And let me say here that when I speak of living with hope, I'm not speaking only of living with great, exuberant hope. There is a kind of hope which I think Paul was speaking of when he spoke of endurance. He thanked God for his sufferings and saying that sufferings brought endurance, required endurance. And endurance I understand as being hope for hope. Endurance I understand to be a state of things when you don't have very much hope, but you hope for hope. And so when I speak of the attitudes we ought to have towards the future and the present and the past, I'm speaking of the possibilities not only of living with exuberant hope, but the possibilities of living with this hope, which is better called endurance. Living with the hope that you will be given hope, that hope will be given to you. Now let's try to understand this in terms of politics. Yesterday's lecture, I stress the notion that we shouldn't try to imagine the future. It seems to me that this has a strong and important political application. Because surely it is true that the effort to imagine the future, the notion that we can comprehend the future, this has been a major source of the disasters that the 20th century has suffered. Not the only source, but a major source. My impression is that if you wrote a brief intellectual sketch of the background of this idea, that one might start with Hegel. No doubt you could go earlier. You can always go back earlier. But with Hegel, there came powerfully into human thinking the notion that we can comprehend the historical future. It's true Hegel said that the philosopher of history looks back. But nevertheless, Hegel thought that one could comprehend the pattern of history, the entire pattern of history. And this implied that it was possible to comprehend the future. With Hegel, this is a relatively high idea. Seems to me to have been a very wrong idea, and an idea which was incompatible with the fact that Hegel was a Christian, because it was contrary to the humility, the epistemological humility, if you will, that Hegel should have felt as a Christian. But no great damage, perhaps, was done with Hegel. The damage, however, came to be done when Marx set Hegel on his feet, as Marx put it, and when Marx's ideas were taken up by Lenin. With Marx to some degree, and with Lenin strongly, Hegel's notion that we can comprehend the future turned into the notion that we can plan and control the future. The future is subject to human mastery. And the Bolshevik Revolution and what happened in the Soviet Union, and to that extent even what happened in Russia during these past few days, has its origin in this grave mistake that we can comprehend the future and that we can lead ourselves into the future, that we can envision the future, and then we can move into that future deliberately. What this means, and most of you will dislike this, but what this means is that so far as the future is concerned in politics, as in personal life, in politics as in personal life, we have to walk in darkness. We may not like this. In fact, we're bound not to like it, because we're very inclined, as the prophet Isaiah put it, to want to kindle a fire and set brands alight and to see into the future. Otherwise, we feel terribly insecure, because we feel that we have nothing to count on but God. And when we feel we have nothing to count on but God or transcendence, we think things are very bad indeed. I remember the story about a man who was on a ship at sea, and a big storm was coming up, and he went to the captain and asked, "How bad are things?" And the captain said that we simply have to trust in God. And this man, who was a Christian, said, "Are things that bad?" And that's the way we feel, I think, when we feel we have nothing to trust in but God. But that truly is our state, because we don't have powers of foresight and control. And I think this is particularly true in our present situation. It needs to be applied. I attained this insight through talking to some of the faculty members here at UBC during a luncheon today. And I was talking with two different ones about the swift and drastic changes that are coming upon us. They're coming upon universities like this, and that are coming upon the world. Profound changes, and how things are being transformed. This is very nerve-wracking for this to be happening, and naturally we want to see ahead. But I think that we have to understand that we're not able to see ahead. However much we want to see ahead, that's something which we can't do. We simply have got to walk in darkness. And those who are Christians have strong biblical authority for doing this, because Isaiah again and again emphasizes the importance of doing that. He says, "I will lead the blind." God says this, "I will lead the blind in ways they know not. In paths they have not known, I will guide them. I will turn the darkness before them into light, and rough places into level ground." That is the voice of faith, as I understand it. And it seems to me that the history of Bolshevism and communism in this country strongly underlines the political importance of doing that.
as hard as it is. This brings us back to the present. Yesterday I emphasized that in our personal lives we have to live our present situation. This I think we also have to do politically. We have to live our present situation politically. What does this mean to live in our present situation? I suggest to you here the concept of necessity, of seeking out, of trying to do what we must do. What we must do. This is what I mean by the concept of necessity. Now, this is both a practical and a moral concept. It's practical in the sense that we have to look at existing circumstances and see what demands they put on us. But we have to interpret existing circumstances in the light of the moral law and see what those circumstances, as illuminated by the moral law, what they require us to do. The main place from which I got this idea, where I feel the power of the idea, doesn't have anything particularly to do with politics, although it was connected with the politics, and this was in Luther's stance at Worms. And Luther, in his perhaps apocryphal words, as all of you know, said in response to the demand that he recant, he said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." And his attitude was not that he knew what the future was bringing. Luther, I'm sure, had no conception of what he was bringing about and of the kind of shaking of the foundations which he was bringing about. He was simply doing what he felt compelled in the light of circumstances and the moral law to do. And this seems to me to express the rule of necessity in politics, that we should do that. How can you know what necessity is? I suggest to you that we do have a faculty for knowing necessity. While we don't have a faculty of foresight, we do have a faculty for knowing what we must do here and now in our present circumstances. And this faculty is usually called conscience. And conscience, I understand, to be not merely a faculty for knowing what the moral law is, but a faculty also for estimating the demands of the moral law within existing circumstances. A person of keen conscience is able to look at the circumstances which exist and have some notion as to what must be done, where you must stand. Now, this could be applied to any number of different problems, I think. I would suggest, as one way of thinking about it, the situation in Bosnia. And I have to speak mainly here about the debate that's going on in my own country about that, but I assume this debate is not entirely different from the way in which you Canadians think about the situation there. What we see in Bosnia, of course, is something called with some accuracy genocide. We're seeing one of the terrible events of history take place again. By the way, I'm not sure what we ought to do in Bosnia. But there are both moral and practical considerations which come into this. And the moral considerations are that we, the Western nations, can't stand aside and let the things that are going on there continue to happen. We have to intervene. The practical considerations are that perhaps we can't really do anything. The Soviet Union, after all, kept order in Bosnia for about a half a century. And as soon as the Soviet Union broke down, disorder immediately erupted, which indicates that simply keeping order is an endless task. And what is happening these days in Somalia indicates that it's not very easy for outside powers to go into these disorderly situations and fix them. So it is possible to argue that as much as we would like to, we simply can't do anything in Bosnia. This is beyond our powers as outsiders. Where this leads you, I'm not sure. I do think that people like Anthony Lewis of the New York Times are wrong. Anthony Lewis feels strongly the moral necessity of going into Bosnia. But necessity is not only moral, it's practical. And there are other people, some of whom are among Clinton's advisors, I believe, who believe that it is practically impossible for us to do anything in Bosnia. Those are people who are adhering to practical necessity. What we must do in this situation is through conscience to try to discover what is necessary, to try to discover what our times call upon us to do in that situation. Finally, let's look at the past. Here, I repeat a theme which I said yesterday, but I repeat it in political terms. Yesterday, I put forth the paradoxical proposition that to live with hope is to look back, not forward. To live with hope, to be sure, is to let yourself be led into the future. Otherwise, you could not be a reformer. Otherwise, you could not carry on a politics of change. But I suggested that paradoxically, to live with hope is to look back into your past rather than looking ahead. And I suggest to you here that this applies also to politics. Now, while we should not try to look ahead, we should try to look back to the past. And I think there is no more important political task facing Western nations now than meditating upon the terrible events which make the past seem unacceptable and horrifying. To meditate on those events and try to understand what meaning they have. An outstanding example of something that requires us to do this is the Holocaust. I was asked briefly about this at the end of the lecture yesterday evening. I couldn't say very much then, but I want to say a little bit more about it now. If we are to seize on one event which stands out from all others in our century as being the event which you can't swallow, which you can't make out to be meaningful, which you can't accept, the one event which makes history appear to be absurd, it would be the death of 6 million people, mostly Jews, in the death camps of Nazi Germany. Many people take the view of the Holocaust that it is somehow impious even to suggest that it has meaning, that all we can do is to stand back in horror at what human beings did. But the view I suggested to you yesterday is that the deepest grounds of hope are grounds which Augustine established when he fought against the Manichaeans. And that is that God governs the universe in every detail. Human beings do things which God doesn't want them to do, but in doing those things, they don't get out of God's control. They don't initiate things which God simply has to look at with horror and can do nothing about. God is able to, I'm using here a metaphor, somebody here, I think in this audience, used when we were just talking about it afterwards. God is a very clever weaver, and he is able to take things, even like the Holocaust, and to weave them into the tapestry of human life, so that ultimately these things have meaning. Now it's up to us as inhabitants of God's universe to try to discover these meanings. And if we don't get any sense of these meanings at all, if we never get a sense that something like the Holocaust is meaningful, then we're going to be stuck with the attitude which Sartre expressed, as I reported to you yesterday, when he said that anything can happen. Anything. Then we're stuck with the notion that history is absurd. So I suggest that one of our most important political tasks is meditating on the Holocaust. Here, I think Christians should stand right alongside Jews. As you probably know, there is a whole group of people now who are arguing that the Holocaust didn't happen. And this is a form of anti-Semitism, a somewhat subtle form of anti-Semitism, but that's what it is. And here it seems to me that Christians have the deepest interest in standing on the side of Jews and insisting that the Holocaust be remembered. You might still ask, is there any possibility at all, how possibly can anything like the Holocaust be found to be meaningful? Well, it pretty much struck the other day when a friend of mine had been in Washington and gone into the, there's a new Holocaust memorial in Washington, which brings before you, I gather, quite vividly everything that happened in the Holocaust. This friend of mine is not a Christian, but she ordered, after coming out of this museum, she said she felt uplifted. So she says she's not a Christian, so this is a purely spontaneous comment, but it's a very revealing comment, that she felt uplifted. Somehow the report of that event, somehow the report of that, the way this is reported in the memorial, in the Holocaust memorial, enabled her to discern some kind of meaning in the Holocaust. I reported to you yesterday the comment of Etty Hilzen, the young Jewish woman. This is in response to a question. The young Jewish woman who was killed at Auschwitz and who recorded in her journal her experience of the coming of the Nazis and of the tightening of the noose around the Jews, and recorded her consciousness that her friends were being killed and she was going to be killed. And the fact that, nevertheless, she said, in the midst of all of this, that in some mysterious sense, everything is justified. Everything is as it ought to be. She knew that everything was horrendous from a certain point of view, from a human point of view. But as a deeply religious person, Etty Hilzen had a sense that things were somehow deeply meaningful. Let me give you one other idea as to how we might discover meaning in events of this kind. I've seen this in connection with the Civil War in the United States. The Civil War in the United States, the war between the states, was a kind of Holocaust in its own right, not quite on a scale with Dachau and Auschwitz and so forth, but it was a kind of Holocaust in itself. The great battles that took place in the American Civil War were horrific occasions. They were relatively brief, and the longest of those battles was the Battle of Gettysburg, which lasted for 3 days. But these battles were just a storm of fire and of killing, in which thousands of young men on both sides were killed, and thousands more were wounded in ways which required gruesome operations, where they had very little in the way of anesthetics. And the battles were, for the people who went through them, these were as terrible as anything that could have happened in the Holocaust. Americans have been engaged in a kind of century and a quarter act of meditation on the Civil War, trying to understand what happened. This has begun by Abraham Lincoln, who was forced somehow to try to comprehend what had gone on and to understand this as being in accordance with God's purposes. And Americans are attaining, about the Civil War, something which isn't quite a sense of horror any longer. It's a sense of awe, almost a sense of reverence before these events. I'm not trying to explain how this is possible, but it's something which clearly does happen, and it is of the utmost importance to anyone who wants to live with hope, because you can't live with hope if you think that past events like the Holocaust and the American Civil War are simple absurdities. If history is absurd, then God does not govern the universe. Transcendence is not dominant in the universe. History is absurd, and there is no room for hope. You have to live not with hope, but rather with fear, if that is the case. So the past calls to us to meditate on it and to try to comprehend it. Now, this is the general nature of the politics of hope, as I comprehend it. Not looking to the future, dwelling in accordance with, living and acting in accordance with present necessities, and looking back and trying to discover in the most defiant materials the reality of meaning in the things that have happened in the past. I suggest that to the extent that we can do this, we will bring into being a new kind of political mind. I'm only in the process now of trying to understand this new political mind. It's a kind of political mind which I think is of the utmost importance that we bring to birth. If I had to characterize it by a word, I would suggest a word which I'm not sure is the best possible word, but to me is a rather good word, and a word which has much meaning for Christians, and that is the word patience. By patience, I don't mean just bearing evils, particularly not evils which happen to other people and not to you. Bearing those without protest. If patience comes to mean that, if it comes to mean bearing the poverty of other people, for example, willingly, then it's worthless as patience. It's morally worthless. By patience, I'm thinking rather of the self-possession which enables human beings to live the historical situation and to concentrate on the demands on them now. And I was led to this idea by passages in the Brothers Karamazov. There is a place in the Brothers Karamazov, and by the way, I think Dostoevsky is not just a great novelist. I think he is the great Christian prophet of our times. And this his greatness comes out in these passages in which Ivan Karamazov, who was an atheist, examines Alyosha Karamazov, who was a believer. And Ivan is trying to understand how these terrible things that happen can be meaningful. Here he's thinking, Ivan is thinking merely of the death of one innocent child, as Albert Camus was later. How can there be meaning in these terrible events? And Alyosha is not able to give him an answer. And Ivan falls into a kind of frenzy in which he says, I must have justice now. I must have justice here and now. Dostoevsky, in reporting Ivan's frenzy, is reporting the kind of frenzy which overtook many of the leaders in Russia in 1917 and which led to the Bolshevik Revolution. He's reporting on the impatience, the inability to live the situation and to observe human limits and to search for the inherent meaning or the will of God that we can discover in the necessities of history. And another way of putting what I said earlier, when I suggested that the disasters of our time have been made by trying to look ahead, is to suggest that the disasters of our time have been made by impatience, by impatient human beings. And if a new political mind can come into existence, it is, in my mind, a mind that would be characterized by patience, by being able to bear with things. This is not at all, as I understand the concept of patience, it's not at all a matter of conservatism. It's not at all a matter of saying, well, everything is terrible, but there's nothing we can do about it. That would be contrary to that reformist attitude, which I said is required by hope at the beginning. Patience doesn't mean that. It's a rather what patience has to do with is the matrix of action. Patience doesn't lead to inaction. It rather leads to an observant, self-possessed, reverent attitude before events, before circumstances, in which you ask what is necessary. And in doing that, prepare for action. Prepare for reform. Prepare for doing things to create a better social order. Patience, however, does have to do with something which I think we have to make room for in politics. And I'm not sure exactly how we do this, but we have to make room somehow for suffering in politics. This is another Dostoevskian insight. We have to act, but the powers of action are limited. And above everything else, one thing we can't do through acting is to make people better. That's one thing we don't know how to do. We don't know how to make people better. We don't know how to create virtuous human beings. That requires suffering. At least that seems to be what the cross says to us. That it is through suffering that the sinfulness, the worldliness, the misdirection of energies and of attention, which constitutes sin, it is through suffering that those things are burned away. Among people in America, the notion of suffering is highly offensive. People in America feel that if you suffer, this must be because you've lost control of things, and if you lost control of things, this somehow is humiliating. It shows that you're not really smart and aren't really figuring things out. They assume somehow or other that suffering should not occur. Christians can't possibly think that. The crucifixion tells us that suffering has got to occur. And I think we have to try to understand how suffering can be given political significance. I can give you just one hint as to how this might happen. One reason why Abraham Lincoln, is so important, a political figure, and I take it I'm not talking about just as an American. He belongs to the ages, and that is to everyone, as Seward suggested. But one reason for Lincoln's greatness as a president, it was not just the things he did, although he did things very significant and very skillfully, it was that he suffered. His time in the White House was 5 years, or 4 or 5 years, whatever it came to, finally, of torment and agony. And this has something to do with his grandeur as a political personality. He didn't just act. He suffered. And this, I think, has had great political meaning. I said I could give you just one hint, but as I was talking, I thought of another. It's not a hint. It's rather an example of what making room for politics and suffering might mean. This is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It wouldn't be easy to find a political personality in the 20th century who was altogether more significant for us than Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran theologian who died in the resistance to Hitler. In a sense, Bonhoeffer's life politically was a failure. The efforts to assassinate Hitler, which he was involved in, of course, came to nothing. Bonhoeffer was arrested, and after 2 years in prison, he was hanged. His life was, in that sense, a failure. But it was a failure in a way which reminds us of the way in which the life of Jesus was a failure. It ended in suffering and in death. And yet somehow we would have to count Bonhoeffer as among the significant political figures in the 20th century. And as most of you know, there are countless works and discussions of Bonhoeffer in connection with situations like South Africa and what Bonhoeffer means in connection with those situations. Well, the concept of patience in this new political mind I'm suggesting, the concept of patience is meant to comprise a willingness on the part of human beings to suffer and to try to give suffering political significance. Let me bring this to a close by again going back to Lincoln. Lincoln is much more than I realize, I think this whole notion of what hope means I gained from Lincoln, because Lincoln was a man of great hope, otherwise could not possibly have withstood the assaults of fate that befell him during the Civil War. He was a man of great hope. But it's striking to me that Lincoln didn't try to see what was coming. He avowed that he didn't know what was coming in the future. He tried to concentrate on present necessities. And he said in one particularly explicit statement that in all of his acts, he had never tried to plan, he had merely tried to discover what it was requisite for him to do in the existing situation. He didn't know where these acts would lead, but he did try to discover what he had to do in the existing situation. So he didn't look ahead. He lived his situation, and in doing this also he looked back. He was very conscious of living out of the American past, out of a past characterized by such documents as the Declaration of Independence, characterized by the rise of democracy with Andrew Jackson. And he was very conscious of ideals of this sort, so he lived in relation to the past, but not in relation to the future. In relation to the future, he simply entrusted his and his country's life to the future. Lincoln stated his view of things with incomparable force in his second inaugural. And I want to bring these comments to a close by quoting Lincoln from his second inaugural, because he expresses, I think, sharply the new political mind, which I think could arise from our rediscovering the nature of hope. Lincoln says the Almighty has his own purposes. Has his own purposes. Right away, he assumes that these may not be our purposes, and they may not be purposes which we comprehend. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. And when he speaks of offenses, he's speaking of slavery. For he goes on to say, if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which in the providence of God, notice, in the providence of God must needs come. A slavery was as bad as the Holocaust. If slavery is somehow within the providence of God, then we can think that the Holocaust was also within the providence of God. In some sense, we can't understand. But if we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both the North and the South this terrible war, as the war due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Notice the willingness to suffer. The idea that suffering may have meaning. This is a lesson which Americans have not learned particularly well, I would say. He goes ahead, fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue, and notice that Lincoln doesn't know, pretend to know what is going to happen. He doesn't pretend to try to will what's going to happen. He doesn't insist that the war is going to end. He says that if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, still it must be said, and the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That's the politics of patience, and deeply, as I understand it, the politics of hope. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the question is, I think this is an interesting question. I'm glad that you brought it up. The question is whether my emphasis on looking back doesn't imply a certain acceptance of conservatism. And what I would say basically is this, that we look back not with the idea of dwelling within the past and not with the idea of preserving the past. We look back in order to try to discover the meaning which runs through history. And if we discover that meaning, or even to the extent that we discover it, by looking back and by living with conscience our present situation, then we're able to live into the future. So the true understanding of the past is an understanding which carries us into the future. I think hope requires conservatism to the extent that it requires maintaining continuity with the past and knowing the past. And there is a certain conservative resonance to words of that kind. I would agree. But looking back, I understand to be a preparation for living ahead. Yes. The question is, how would I fit the Puritan experience and the project of building a new Jerusalem on the hill? How would I fit that to the sort of thing that I'm saying? Strangely enough, I see the Puritan effort as having something in common with the communist effort. I admire the Puritans. The Puritans were very serious people, as you know, and it's hard not to like that, particularly if you're a Christian, and particularly if you're living among all of the frivolities of modern industrial society. Then to look back to those Puritans in Boston in the 17th century, there's something heartening about this, because these were people who took God very seriously. And the question is to what God called upon them to do. But it does seem to me that they made a fundamental error in thinking that what God called upon them to do was to build a Christian society upon earth. And it does seem to me that that had a certain likeness with what the Bolsheviks attempted to do some centuries later. And so I see this as a great tragic straying of Christians from the past of what Christianity really means. It's been suggested there's a lot of room for discussion of all of this, and I don't by any means comprehend it, but it's been suggested that this error, the possibility of this error, somehow is inherent in the Reformed tradition, that is, in the Calvinist tradition, and that Lutheran, Catholic, other traditions are not so susceptible to making this error. I'm not sure whether that is true or not. It does seem to me to have been a terrible error. Now, other questions? Yes?
I was wondering, both your examples of the ancient Paul Pitts, Abraham, and Grandma, they were moved at some point to the Western courts. Yes, in light of the dignity of the person, do you think these support the bottom?
I didn't quite get the last. What does it mean?
Like Karl Watts suggests, the inhabitants.
Here I would side with Bonhoeffer against Hauerwas. And Bonhoeffer, as you know, took part in an assassination plot and volunteered to be the assassin himself. I have read on good authority that he did. What's your authority for saying he didn't?
He was already in prison.
But before he went to prison, when he joined the assassination plot, when he joined it, he agreed to pull the trigger if necessary. I believe he did, but I would be interested if you can give me a citation which would enable me to see better that. Well, I would be interested in that. In any case,
he was
He didn't go to prison, of course, until July of 1943, and was in prison for 2 years, but he had been a part of the assassination plot for several years before that.
He agreed with the use of force.
He agreed with the use of force, and agreed to use the force himself, or to support those who used the force. And I think he agreed to pull the trigger, but I'd be interested in the citation if you can give me one. Let me go ahead here. But I would side with Bonhoeffer on this, in that Bonhoeffer's position is paradoxical, that you have to use force in spite of the dictates of love, which lead someone like Hauerwas in the direction of pacifism. I think we have to live the paradox that Bonhoeffer enacted. Now, I won't go any. I won't. Mm-hmm. He did.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And that he might have to pay for it somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I have a question from the back. When you describe alternate revolution as an example of the patience and leading to one of the disasters of our time, would you extend that to virtually all of every revolutionary movement?
Yes, the question is whether I would extend what I have said about the Bolshevik Revolution to every revolutionary movement. And I would extend it to every serious revolutionary movement. There have obviously been successful revolutions. Some took place have a certain look of success at this time in Poland, in Eastern Europe, and in my own country, in the United States, there was a successful revolution. But these were in somewhat special circumstances. And the American Revolution, in a sense, wasn't a genuine revolution, if you judge it by the standards of the French Revolution or the Soviet Revolution or the Chinese Revolution. And I would suggest that the notion of drastically and swiftly changing human society is beyond capacities, and that in almost every case, when people attempt to do this, it's going to go amiss. Now, this doesn't mean I would never favor revolution. Sometimes, probably, it has to occur. Perhaps in the Union of South Africa, it's going to have to occur yet. But I would say that when it does have to occur, this is a tragic necessity and something into which human beings should not go with their hearts lifted up. Yes? Well, why don't you start there? I don't see why. I guess the statement is that revelation implies revolution, and I guess I don't see in what way it does. It seems to me that depends on the nature of the revelation, but I don't see the Christian revelation implies revolution. He certainly didn't have Bonhoeffer's blessing. Yes, yes, but that's, of course, a scandal.
Okay. So, there is somebody at Revelation. This man was Messianic.
Well, I wouldn't call that a revelation by Christian standards.
Uh-huh. But if one has to say that Bonhoeffer had a contrary revelation, that in fact, this was evil. So he was responsible by the revelation to cause a minor revolution by trying to destroy Hitler. But they have a certain revelation of what they want to do politically in the United States. It implies a kind of revolution. I just wonder if you know about this or whether you're familiar with some of these leaders.
No, the question, the comments concern the relationship between revelation and revolution, and I would much prefer not to use the word revelation as you're using it, because it seems to me that we don't normally call somebody's insight or conviction into what should be done, we don't normally call that a revelation. That we normally refer to revelation something, a disclosure by God, the revealing of transcendence. And that, it seems to me, revelation in that ultimate sense of the word, it seems to me, does not necessarily imply revolution. Liberation theologians would say that it does, but I've argued the contrary in what I've been saying about hope today. So that's really an open question, although I would close the question to the extent that I could, in that I would argue against liberation theology. Yes. I'm sorry, I'll come over here next. It certainly requires both. I would think that it's something which can and must be done by individuals, but remembering the Holocaust and building memorials and talking about the Holocaust, this is something which all of us have to do together. And so this is certainly a collective responsibility in addition to being an individual responsibility. I think we all, to the extent possible, we all together should be engaged in this great human task of remembering and trying to make sense out of the past. But typically, we do our collective projects very badly. And if an individual awaited the collective fulfillment of these tasks, the individual would be often weighed down and constrained by the ineptitude and the superficiality of the collective. And so individuals, I think, have to engage in these acts of memory too. And I think each one of us, say in our times of prayer and meditation, ought to meditate upon events, at least from time to time, like the Holocaust. Yes, you're...
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll sort of make my further notes in reference to the rise and fall of the Third Reich, or I mean your comments on the American Civil War. It just is appropriate because the source of the problem is the same. Within the context of Third Reich, from my little bit of readings and what people have told me what happened, it went to the point possibly the Jews at that time were doing wrong things.
Since everybody is doing wrong things most of the time, probably the Jews were too.
Obviously, it went to the point where it went evil, it went completely anti-Christian.
No, I don't know about that.
Let's take the question there from Rick and Hope, because a lot of other people have questions here now too. You could perhaps just make a comment on in the context of our memory of the past and remembrance of the Holocaust, and that to what degree the Jews have responsibility is being suggested here for this. Is this something that we can fit into that framework at all?
I didn't quite follow what she was saying, but the solution that I have, I'm basically a pacifist Christian, and I would like to be a communist if equality with all people could happen, but it doesn't seem to be able to happen. But as far as dealing with either individual or group military atrocities, I do believe in execution of definitely people that have killed twice, whether it's an individual or a group.
Okay. Thank you for your comment.
And one other thing, I feel that the that the structural change should come within our traditional organizations, or else if these changes are either proven wrong or do not agree within the structural organizations, they have to start on their own.
Right. Our last question, I think we're going to have to close it. Is there a last question? John.
Tiffany, your theory has a very fine line. On the one hand, you quite rightly reject utopia. especially if it's a humanistic utopia. On the other hand, you wish to express a doctrine of hope, which is reformist, and it basically, therefore, is on some form ideal of perfectibility.
With limits, which we can't know in advance. With limits. I think you may sound a little more sweeping than I intend for it to be when you call it an idealistic perfectibility. I assume that that God's moral commands, in effect, are commands to perfect ourselves and to perfect the societies in which we live. That doesn't mean to make them perfect, because presumably the eschatological passages to which I referred earlier say that we're not going to be able to make society perfect. But the moral law, which we have inherited from Judaism, the moral law wouldn't have very much meaning unless we could perfect ourselves, unless we could become better. That's my source, this idea.
All right, with that, I would simply like to thank Dr. Kinder for a stimulating, provocative, interesting series. And as I've mentioned, he will be speaking again. It is tomorrow at 12:30 again noon in IRC 4. So thank you very much, Dr.
Thank you.